to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to start the show by talking about hunting and wildlife conservation. We'll take a look at the connection between the two with our guest today. He's Buddy Huffaker, who is the board president and executive director of the Aldo Leopold Foundation. What questions do you have about hunting and conservation? Love to hear from you. Maybe you are someone who just got started hunting. Maybe you're new to it. How'd you get started? Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. Don't forget to check out the new Ideas Network page. You can hear about all of our shows right on that page as well. Buddy Huffaker, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk first about the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Many listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with it, but talk about the foundation, what it does, and what it's about.
Yeah. So the Leopold Foundation was established by the five children of Aldo Leopold. We own and manage the property that inspired Leopold to write his famous book, A Sand County Almanac. That property is located outside of Baraboo, Wisconsin, on the Wisconsin River. And then we also serve as the executor of Leopold's literary estate. So we work to keep A Sand County Almanac in circulation, translated into new languages, brought out in new formats. And so we have both this kind of very place-based nature of our work, taking care of and still doing wildlife management and research on the ground, but then also this kind of national, global effort to just promote Leopold's most famous idea that he termed a land ethic. And that was really his call to challenge people to recognize that we're a part of the biological community, not apart from it. And if we understand that, then we'll kind of give the same ethical consideration to the flora and fauna that we give our friends and family, and therefore hopefully take better care of the resources that sustain life of all forms.
So the business of hunting and conservation, what's the give a little history of that whole relationship?
Well, most of modern conservation is really founded on hunting as an activity, and I think we could generalize hunting as moving from subsistence to sport hunting, but that's a really crude and general generalization. In the 1800s, as a result of market hunting, we saw lots of species go extinct and populations massively decline, the passenger pigeon being a significant one, the decline of bison is another kind of typical example. And it was really the hunting community that began to change the way in which we engage wildlife and create restrictions on game hunting, licenses that would generate revenue for habitat protection and improvement. And so a lot of modern conservation is really built off of those early efforts by the hunting community to kind of clean up its act and make bigger investments for the future.
Yeah. And the benefits of, you know, there are some benefits of hunting. I think you could talk about it ecologically, also socially and economically as well.
Yeah, well, you know, the ecological ones are kind of relatively straightforward. Our deer population in the state of Wisconsin requires management now for its own health and the health of human citizens in terms of deer car collisions and all sorts of other kind of health risks. Geese is another species that hunting is really important for managing that population that has really come back very successfully. But also land protection and habitat improvement are funded almost exclusively through hunting license sales and excise taxes. Socially, there is the kind of tradition of hunting. Larry, before the show, we were talking about time you spend in the woods with your daughter, turkey hunting. And that time outdoors, the ability to recharge, connect with the natural world, has both social and personal benefits. But the one that is really hard to ignore is the economic benefits of hunting. Nationally, hunting is a $38 billion economy. So that's more total revenue generated from hunting direct and indirect sales than Google or Goldman Sachs total gross revenue. So we're talking real money.
Yeah.
And then in the state of Wisconsin alone, it's over $3 billion in economic activity. So again, a really important part of Wisconsin's economy. Wisconsin actually is first in the nation in the impact of hunting to the state's economy, and number one in economic impact of non-resident hunters. So it's one of the things we do well is those folks from Illinois and Minnesota who come to take part and take advantage of our wonderful natural resources, we're capturing their investment in our natural resources in part through hunting.
So lots of potential benefits there and real benefits as well from it. And the Leopold, before we go to the phones here, the Leopold Foundation, how do you work with hunters?
Well, this is a relatively new area for us. People who have read a Sand County Almanac and who haven't read it really closely sometimes are surprised to realize that Leopold was a lifelong hunter. In fact, many argue that if not for his experience as a hunter, he would have never come to this idea of a land ethic. That gave him such a powerful insight into how the land worked as an ecological system. And so what we're seeing in the state of Wisconsin and nationally is declines in hunter participation rates, which will have very direct and indirect impacts on conservation funding and implementation. And so in recognizing that, we want to just help open up the conversation about the values of hunting. So we have some events coming up. We have a publication that's going to be coming out later this fall titled Why Hunt, a guidebook for lovers of nature, local food, and outdoor recreation, making sure those that care about these things consider hunting and understand their importance economically and ecologically. So we do have some hunting on our property, but again, this is kind of a new area of our work to kind of open up the conversation about hunting and its impact on conservation.
I think one area where we're seeing some increase is in hunting is the growing trend, I think, of more women becoming involved and interested in hunting, and what's attracting them?
Yeah, great point, Larry. So again, overall, the numbers are a little grim. Hunting participation rates are in pretty steep decline, which are going to have real impacts. There are a couple bright spots. A lot is driven by interest in local and healthy food. And women are the one demographic where we're seeing an increase in hunting participation. And some more research still needs to be done to nail down exactly why, but we think it's some of the speculation is around the health, both the healthy lifestyle, food, and mm-hmm. being outdoor, the connection with family, again, spending time without distractions of the cell phone and other modern technologies. We know that that's often quite important to mothers and to women. And so those are some of the drivers, we think, of why women are getting more engaged. And I think another really important point is trying to tear down some of the stigma around hunting and mm-hmm. creating more openness and inclusive environments for women to learn about hunting. Because there's a lot of barriers to becoming a hunter that often those that have participated for a long time don't fully appreciate. So I think the hunting community itself, the ecological and conservation community, are just trying to be more open and inclusive. And I think we're seeing some of the results of that.
Well, Jim and Larson has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Morning, Larry. Morning, buddy. I certainly agree with you that wildlife is a good source of food if you're going to be a carnivore. If you're not, I guess it doesn't really matter. But for people that are thinking about doing this, particularly with regard to deer hunting, there's some new research that's coming out of Canada that's a bit disconcerting regarding chronic wasting disease, and that is that researchers have ground up known infected meat and fed it to other primates, namely rhesus monkeys. And unfortunately, those rhesus monkeys have developed chronic wasting disease themselves. So it can jump the species barrier, at least in the research lab. All of this sort of stuff is really kind of upsetting for people that hunt deer in Wisconsin, and particularly since it's such an economic importance to the state. It's sort of amazing that we now have baiting being essentially the limit on baiting being lifted, when we know that this is a way in which chronic wasting disease is being spread. So for those people who are thinking about going deer hunting, be sure to get it tested. It's too bad that the DNR is not testing more like they were in the past, but that's the way of the world with this administration. People should be aware of it and be concerned about the future of our deer herd.
All right, buddy, a comment. Thank you for calling, Jim.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. I am aware of that research. I've not dug into it to kind of fully digest it myself, but it is something that we all need to be aware of. I would also agree and echo Jim's concerns about the diminishment of opportunity to check deer, but it's still possible. So while CWD is certainly something to be aware of and be concerned about, there are still many deer in the mm-hmm. state herd that are not infected with the disease. If you harvest a deer, you can have it tested, and I would encourage you to do so. And so, again, as with all of this, being informed and mindful is the most important criteria. So Jim brings up big issues that we all need to be mindful of, but lots of opportunities to work around that as well.
Yeah, and I think I saw the other day where the number of people getting the deer tested is dropping, and you take advantage of that.
Yeah, some of it is about availability. They've reduced the number of stations, and you have to go drop it off yourself, and so some of that is access and convenience. Probably more a reflection of that than interest and concern.
We have Deb on Facebook says the hunter safety classes should teach safe ways to be in the woods with a weapon. Too many that she's seen have been exposed are mostly older guys volunteering their time and telling stories. A more rigid curriculum would be good for all. I think that depends quite a bit on, for I took my daughter through the hunter safety program, and I was really impressed with the Hope Rod and Gun Club, as I'll name them, because that was the group. These guys knew what they were doing. They had some stories to tell, but they were tended to be stories that were examples of what to do and what not to do in the woods. So,
Larry, again, I would echo your experience. I probably 4 years ago took all of my three children through hunter safety. I went through it myself because I did not grow up hunting, so I wanted to have that same knowledge and awareness and safety information that they had. And I was really impressed. This was at Dane County where we took our class. But the thoroughness and how much time was spent on gun safety
in the woods,
in any format, I think was really important and impressive. My wife, who participated as well, her comment afterwards was, "Well, I still am not sure whether I will ever hunt, but I feel much more comfortable with my family hunting now." Mm-hmm. So I'm sure it's a bit of a case-by-case basis, but most of our hunter safety education instructors and settings really emphasize this. But that is one of the barriers to getting into hunting, is just that comfort and confidence in weapons and firearms. And so that's, again, something that I think the community has worked really hard about improving, is that students go through that hunter safety course, really come away with understanding how to be safe in the woods.
And thanks very much, Deb, for that comment. Nate on Facebook agrees that hunting is a source for local sustainable food. Any animals harvested require no agricultural inputs. So not only are you eating meat that requires no inputs, but you are displacing the meat you should have, you might have bought from a store, which requires at least some inputs.
Yeah, Nate brings up a good point here, and I don't want to get into too many nuances, but we need to be a little careful when we say hunting is a sustainable source of food. I mean, if everybody went out hunting and the whole population was trying to sustain itself off of wildlife, we would have problems. But we could easily sustain 50, 100,000, 150,000 more people eating an exclusively wild game diet. And there would be all these other benefits, health, personal health, ecological health, economic health associated with that. But it's also, I think, worth noting in his comment about no agricultural inputs. Well, one of the reasons our deer population is so healthy, arguably over healthy, is that we have created the ideal habitat across the landscape, particularly in southern Wisconsin, for deer. Mixed woods interspersed with farm fields. So there are cheap food buffets for deer and geese in the form of waste corn and agricultural products. So just a slight caveat, but I agree fully with Nate's point.
I saw an exclosure, what they call an exclosure, in an alfalfa field, actually. And you look at the field, and a lot of the field looks pretty good, but then you go to the exclosure where deer were not able to get in, and that alfalfa is like 8 inches higher. It is amazing.
Yeah, exactly. We actually have some exclosures on our property. We're working with Dr. Don Waller here at the University of Wisconsin to study and really try to understand the impacts of the deer herd on our flora, native flora across the state. And of course, many farmers can get extra deer tags because of the recognition that too many deer in one area can have on a farmer's agricultural productivity.
Buddy Huffaker, our guest today, board president and executive director of the Aldo Leopold Foundation, talking about hunting as a sustainable food source with him. And certainly looking forward to hearing what you have to say. So give a call, go to our Facebook page, or the ideas at WPR.org email. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we'll take a look at how our cool, wet summer affected our wetlands. So I hope you'll stay with us for that right now. Buddy Huffaker, board president and executive director of the Aldo Leopold Foundation, our guest here on the Ideas Network as we talk hunting as a sustainable food source. Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You know, before it gets away from us, I want to bring up the events that you've got coming up, buddy, and so we don't miss those before we go back to the phones and the email and the Facebook. So what have you got for us?
Yeah, a couple quick things. We have this handbook coming out called Why Hunt, which is an introduction for those curious about hunting or just getting started. Interesting connection to your next guest. That project kind of grew out of some work we did with the Wisconsin Wetlands Association and a publication called My Healthy Wetlands, and really trying to share ecological information with the general public and without using all scientific language. Sometimes scientists get trapped in their own jargon. That's true in hunting as well. We use a lot of terms that for those that don't have experience with hunting can be quite confusing. So that's a new publication we have coming out. And then related to that, we're bringing Robin Milglerini to the area. She's a self-taught hunter. She launched a website called Modern Hunters, and she's a 30-year-old woman who had been a vegetarian, decided she wanted to know where her food came from and didn't want to outsource the job, and so taught herself how to hunt. She's coming to share her story and the challenges as a woman and a non-hunter she had to work through to navigate this new activity. So she's coming. She'll give a talk next week on September 19th at the Discovery Building here on the UW-Madison campus, open house at 5:30, lecture at 6:15, social at 7:15, and then the next day she'll give a talk up at UW-Stevens Point in the Trainer Natural Resource Building. Again, that social starts at 5, talk at 6, and then a social following that. So Robin, I've had a chance to just read some of her work and listen to her podcast. Really captivating speaker. Does a good job of kind of demystifying the process and saying, if I could do it, you could do it too. So again, just another voice that is trying to kind of create this inclusive atmosphere around hunting and help people understand the personal and social benefits of it.
Let's take some more calls. Bob in Lamira, we'll go to you next. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Hey, how are you doing? Hey, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
When you look at the idea of the changes in the CWD baiting, more open taking of does and diminishing of deer herd numbers in certain areas, I can't help but think, being of a cynical or maybe a little bit analytical mind about the business of how much insurance companies really have input on DNR policy. For example, every car accident, car deer accident, is virtually a loss to the insurance company. I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, I'm not. Bob, clearly you make an important connection of the financial impact of deer car collisions to insurance companies. My logic would have then that they would not want baiting. They would want better deer population controls in place. But I might be missing something.
Yeah. Bert in Spring Green, we'll go to you next. Hi, Bert.
Absolutely. There's two issues I'd like to discuss. One is the Pittman-Robinson Act, and then there was the cigarette tax that was supposed to be going just for land acquisition, and they smoothed it over into maintenance. And then the other thing is that when I grew up, we hunted squirrels. When I first started hunting, my dad would give us like 8 bullets or 4 bullets, and we're supposed to come back with 4 squirrels and rabbits, and we worked our way up. It was years and years later that we went hunting for whitetail. Now a kid goes out of hunter safety course, and he immediately is given a high-powered gun and goes out to shoot an animal bigger than he is. It's got to be somewhat traumatic to these young kids at 12 years old to shoot a deer. I'll take my
comments off the air. Okay. Well, there are certain things in place that I think help that process along.
Yeah, a couple of quick things. Pittman-Robinson was established in 1930s, and that's basically an excise tax on firearms, ammunition, and those funds do go directly to wildlife conservation. So a huge financial driver for wildlife habitat protection, management, and research. Bert is absolutely right. And again, my experience is the same as Bert. I didn't start hunting until I was 30 years old. I had to work my way up to deer hunting. And in fact, my oldest son has now harvested more whitetails than I have. But that's one of the things I love about this Robin Miglerini who's coming. She actually talks about that progression, that it's kind of a, you start with small game and get comfortable with it before going to deer hunting. Those are the ingredients. There's a lot of right recipes for different people in different settings. A lot of it depends, I think, on access to good mentors and having somebody go out in the woods with you. But I think really important to be very thoughtful about those that are trying to encourage and welcome new hunters into the community, to kind of think about the progression and try to help ensure success for those new hunters rather than kind of trauma and putting themselves in harm's way.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Kim in Whitehall. Hi, Kim.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to reiterate some of what you talked about on the hunter safety end of it. I had 2 sons several years apart. When the oldest son, I took him to hunter safety in Middleton. It was an absolute waste of time. They never touched a weapon. The instructor who was teaching it was almost like he didn't want to be there. They had a couple of people from the DNR came in and talked to them, and then the only safety thing they did was they strung a piece of ribbon across the parking lot, gave them an empty 22, and it showed them how to safely cross a fence with a weapon, and that was it. And then my youngest son, we went up to a rod and gun club in Lodi, and they were exemplary. Every night, the students had to bring a different weapon with them. They had to safely show that it was unloaded. They had to handle the weapons. They had multiple classes. They did tree stand safety. They actually had range time. They fired multiple weapons, and it was the best course I have ever seen. So the difference was just night and day, unbelievable.
Yeah. And, of course, your older son, that means that would have been a few years earlier. And I think the program changed over time, did it not, buddy?
That's my understanding. Again, I've only kind of intersected that process once with my own family and kind of something that I'm getting more engaged with. But Keith Warnke from the Wisconsin DNR runs the hunting and shooting sports program. And over the last few years, I think they've worked really hard to, improve the quality and consistency of hunter safety. So, again, Larry, I'll join you in saying we're on the right trajectory of things getting better and more consistent in that environment.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Kim, for calling. Bill in Ashland, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. My issue isn't so much with hunter safety or any things like that. Mine is availability. See, I used to hunt whitetails and many other types of game. Basically, forestal statement, and I lived off of that for the year. Up here in northern Wisconsin, we are not allowed to harvest animals for that reason. Or, you know, like me and my wife, we've gotten one deer, which had to be a buck, in the past 4 years. If now, if we were allowed to shoot a doe instead of a buck, we would have, you know, we would have had venison, you know, every year.
Yeah.
But the problem is that we're not allowed to. Now, if the DNR would change it to an either or for both for bow season and for rifle season, don't care what you shoot, but you only get one tag, I think it'd be a lot easier for more people, and you know, I could go back to enjoying venison instead of having to eat it at friends' houses when I go to visit.
Okay. Well, there are so maybe you can talk about this, buddy. Depending on where you are in the state, you can shoot. In fact, they want you to shoot does.
Yeah, it really is kind of a regional issue, and this is not my area of expertise. Next time you have Scott Craven on, you should ask him specifically about this. But let's just say generically, the northern half of the state, deer populations are not as high as some would like. Let's just kind of leave it at that. And so they have changed the harvest opportunities and restricted it to bucks only at the moment. In the southern half of the state, our population is I think by almost anybody's account, way too high from an ecological perspective. And so therefore, it's not required, but it's strongly encouraged. It had been required. It no longer is required. To harvest antlerless deer before an antlered deer, but it is strongly encouraged. And just quick about the biology there, it's obviously the females in the herd that are the reproductive capacity. And so one buck can impregnate many females. And so in areas where you want the herd to grow, you do not want to harvest female deers. In areas where you want the herd to shrink, you need to harvest female deers. So that's the biology. That's one thing that a lot of people don't actually recognize and appreciate. Research shows is how regulated of an activity hunting is. So harvest requirements are set by state DNR agencies based on the health of a population. So again, that's why we have different regulations in the north and in the south. They're responding to what the population numbers are. Likewise, with migratory birds, the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service sets what the harvest quota can be. And so some non-hunters are really assured to know that this really is a scientifically based activity. It's not you just go out there, shoot whatever you can see or whatever you want. There are a lot of requirements and a lot of information that flows to inform harvest totals and timelines.
Thanks again for calling, Bill. Brian in Janesville, on to you now. Hi, Brian.
Good morning.
What's on your mind today?
I wanted to share an insurance guy's perspective on the deer numbers and insurance companies, because I had the same opinion that you guys shared earlier. And I mentioned that to my insurance agent, who, like me, had a natural resource degree from Stevens Point. And so he had a better intuition into that thing than most people. And he said, look, as an insurance agency, we handle money. The more money we handle, the better our profits are. We have no interest in manipulating the way the deer numbers are. That's the DNR's job. And so I've had a different opinion of that ever since he told me that, and it makes total sense if you think about it.
Yeah, it does indeed. Thanks for calling, Brian. Appreciate it. Lyle in Montello, your turn. Hi, Lyle.
Hi. I guess I'm wondering if the deer hunting people have kind of shot themselves in the foot by making it as popular as it is. I know we're losing hunters every year, but I wonder if that's because everybody's planting all the food plots and buying all the cameras and spending all the money on making their bucks on their property as big as they possibly can, so they don't really want other people coming in on their property and then shooting all the deer that they've worked so hard to get. So for me, anyway, it's hard for me to find a place to hunt because everyone, you know, values their deer so much now with all the farming for them that nobody wants to let other people shoot them.
Yeah. So access, you know, and as we talk about hunting as a, you know, attracting more people to hunting, that's one thing that really is an issue.
Yeah, access certainly can be a limitation for certain people. It probably is more acute in the deer hunting community, although, again, we don't have data on this. It'd be pretty interesting to do some research. I bet there's a lot of private landowners who... maybe because they don't appreciate the importance of hunting, just don't allow hunting. So, A, there'd be an opportunity through education and, you know, in some candor, better behavior by the hunting community. Because I know some landowners who have said, well, you know, deer hunters were the rudest, most inconsiderate group I've ever interacted with, so I just stopped allowing people to hunt. Again, that's a case-by-case basis, but that reputation is out there that we need to be mindful of. And then, you know, that just, Lyle makes an argument for additional investments in public land, be there for hunting opportunities or hiking opportunities. And right now, that is not a priority of this administration. But the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program was one of the vehicles that was in place to help create more access to the out-of-doors. And again, right now, we have other priorities at the state level.
Yeah. I was just thinking about where I hunt. And most of the time, I'm on, if it would be deer hunting, it would be the Chequamegon National Forest as an example. There are places like that where you can hunt, and it's not restricted, but... Your points are well taken, for sure.
And again, you know, I don't deer. The hunting is all about deer, at least in the state of Wisconsin and many other places, for all sorts of reasons. The quality and the quantity of venison, the economics. But again, if we're talking about introducing and engaging new hunters, as a caller pointed out earlier, squirrel hunting. Maybe pheasant hunting. There are other opportunities and activities that might be better introduction vehicles.
And there are some courses. Actually, I can remember my other former producer, Judith Sears-Poisson, took a hunting course and was allowed to go hunting. And it was a DNR-sponsored program where learning how to hunt...
You got it right there. It's called Learn to Hunt, and that's a program that is a great introduction for new hunters. You get biology about the species that you're considering hunting. You get some firearm safety training, and then you get to go out in the field with a mentor. Usually these are outside the traditional hunting season, so it's kind of a unique and special opportunity. And so that Learn to Hunt program has been a great tool to introduce new hunters to the activity. And if you go on the DNR website and type in Learn to Hunt, you'll get a list of where and when those different programs are. And again, those are for pheasants, for turkey, for deer, probably other species that I'm forgetting.
Andy on Facebook says he works for not-for-profit. It's called the Prairie Enthusiasts, which I'm very familiar with that organization, and they depend upon hunting as a major land management tool in terms of ecological restoration.
Yeah, again, Andy and the work of the Prairie Enthusiasts is great work that's being done largely in the southern half of the state. But I think what he's pointing out is... wildlife often have different ecological impacts, and too many deer in confined spaces, again, are not healthy for the deer population, but often not healthy for the land itself. They can overbrowse areas and decrease specific plant populations, trample, and, you know, if you think of deer trails, some properties are just kind of interlaced with deer highways from overuse. So, yeah, prairie enthusiasts are not alone in recognizing the importance of hunting as an ecological restoration and management tool.
And Jeff in Milwaukee, hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hey, Larry, another great show. Thanks a lot. I was up north this weekend, and when I got up Saturday morning, I spent the night overnight in Tomahawk, and then I had a about a little over 100-mile drive from there over to the Cable Drummond area, and I saw some deer in the daytime along the side of the road. I saw a roadkill deer, quite a few, by the way, and then I live in northwest Racine County, and I can go for weeks at a time, maybe even months, and not see a deer in the daytime. And I, like I said, in the short amount of time that I was up there, just over a three-day weekend, I saw a lot of deer.
Yeah. And, you know, that's kind of even, and I don't know if Jeff is a hunter or not, but for non-hunters as well, it's a fun thing to be able to see deer.
Yeah, I mean, again, wildlife have a lot of different values to our society, and the opportunity to see wildlife is kind of probably unrecognized and undervalued. So I think, again, we sometimes take for granted all the resources that the natural resources this state has, and what a beautiful part of the state for Jeff to be driving through.
Yeah,
Cable
for
area
sure.
It's just gorgeous. The other point, and I'm not a deer biologist, but now is the time of year where deer behavior starts to change, so you also start to see wildlife a little bit more. And this is one of the reasons Leopold found so much pleasure and knowledge out of hunting is being mindful of how animals acted and changed season to season, day to day. That fascinated him, and I think that's what you'll hear from a lot of hunters is, oh, yeah, you know, I'm noticing these things now, or I'm expecting this. That's when you really know you're good, is when you're expecting the behavior and it starts to happen. That tells you that you're really tuned in.
And I want to go, before we're done here, go back to those events, because I want to make sure people know about what you've got coming up.
Yeah, well, first, a quick shameless plug. Actually, tomorrow night at the Leopold Center in Baraboo, we'll have Kurt Miney releasing his new book, The Driftless Readers. Kurt is the biographer of Aldo Leopold, so he can answer all these questions about Leopold and hunting much better than I. But he's put together a new assemblage of essays really celebrating the driftless region in the state of Wisconsin. So that's a great publication that we'll release at the Leopold Center tomorrow night. And then next week, we have Robin Miglerini from the Boston area, self-taught clinical psychologist, so not in the conservation world, you know, just a former vegetarian who, again, wanted to be able to eat meat again and didn't want to outsource the job and taught herself to hunt. She'll be here on the Madison campus September 19th in the evening and at UW-Stevens Point on the 20th. In the evening as well. And if you go to our Leopold Foundation website, Why Hunt, you'll find more detailed information about those upcoming activities.
And that's the foundation is Why Hunt? Is that where
it's the Aldo Leopold, www.aldoleopold.org/Why Hunt, and you'll see information on these specific events. And that's where you'll be able to see information about this upcoming handbook that we're releasing. And hopefully a space where we'll develop more content and have more interactive conversations around the value of hunting and conservation moving forward.
Buddy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Larry. And again, we need more of these kind of conversations about the future of conservation. So thanks for having me.
Buddy Huffaker is board president, executive director of the Aldo Leopold Foundation. And I'm sure he'll be back again, and we'll talk about what else is going on with the foundation and probably talk about hunting with him as well. Coming up, though, we're going to take a look at wetlands and get an update on what's going on with our wetlands and even maybe a look at some of the legislation as well. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.